This week on Selected Shorts...
She had always taken great pains to listen carefully when Fortunata spoke of his country's history and mysterious customs. But she wanted a kiss. Was that asking for so much?
Finding Mr. Wright, that's a subject we're addressing on this week's Selected Shorts. And also we get some homeschooling tips from the British humorist Saki.
I teach history on the Schwarzmetterklum method, said the governess loftily. Ah, yes, said her listeners, thinking it expedient to assume an acquaintance, at least with the name.
Hi, I'm Isaiah Sheffer, and you're listening to Selected Shorts from PRI. This series brings together the best actors from Broadway and Hollywood to read great stories, old and new, in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. On this edition of Selected Shorts, you'll hear three tales with twists, the kind that make us ask, hey, how did that happen? How did what happen? What happened? Well, what happened? We'll also hear what happens when Edwige Dantica secretly follows her mother. Let's start with a classic by the English writer H.H. Munro, known by his pen name Saki, The Schwarzmetterklum Method, read by the great American actress Marion Seldes.
Lady Carlotta stepped out onto the platform of the small wayside station and took a turn or two up and down its uninteresting length to kill time till the train should be pleased to proceed on its way. Then, in the roadway beyond, she saw a horse struggling with a more than ample load, and a carter of the sort that seems to bear a sullen hatred against the animal that helps him to earn a living. Lady Carlotta promptly betook her to the roadway and put rather a different complexion on the struggle. Certain of her acquaintances were wont to give her plentiful admonition as to the undesirability of interfering on behalf of a distressed animal, such interference being none of her business. Only once had she put the doctrine of non-interference into practice, when one of its most eloquent exponents had been besieged for nearly 3 hours in a small and extremely uncomfortable may tree by an angry boar pig, while Lady Carlotta, on the other side of the fence, had proceeded with the watercolor sketch she was engaged on and refused to interfere between the boar and his prisoner. It is to be feared that she lost the friendship of the ultimately rescued lady. On this occasion, she merely lost the train, which gave way to the first sign of impatience it had shown throughout the journey and steamed off without her. She bore the desertion with philosophical indifference. Her friends and relations were thoroughly well used to the fact of her luggage arriving without her. She wired a vague, non-committal message to her destination to say that she was coming on another train. Before she had time to think what her next move might be, she was confronted by an imposingly attired lady who seemed to be taking a prolonged mental inventory of her clothes and looks. "You must be Miss Hope, the governess I've come to meet," said the apparition, in a tone that admitted of very little argument. "Very well, if I must, I must," said Lady Carlotta to herself with dangerous meekness. "I am Mrs. Quabble," continued the lady, "and where, pray, is your luggage?" "It is gone astray," said the alleged governess, falling in with the excellent rule of life that the absent are always to blame. The luggage had, in point of fact, behaved with perfect correctitude. "I've just telegraphed about it," she added, with a nearer approach to the truth. "How provoking," said Mrs. Quabble. "These railway companies are so careless. However, my maid can lend you things for the night." She led the way to the car. During the drive to the Quabble mansion, Lady Carlotta was impressively introduced to the nature of the charge that had been thrust upon her. She learned that Claude and Wilfred were delicate, sensitive young people, that Irene had the artistic temperament highly developed, and that Viola was as something or other else of a mould equally commonplace among children of that class and type in the 20th century. I wish them not only to be taught, said Mrs. Quabble, but interested in what they learn. In their history lessons, for instance, you must make them feel that they are being introduced to the life stories of men and women who really lived, not merely committing a mass of names and dates to memory. French, of course. I expect you to talk at mealtimes several days a week. I shall talk French 4 days a week, and Russian, the remaining three. Russian? My dear Miss Hope, no one in this house speaks or understands Russian. That will not embarrass me in the least, said Lady Carlotta coldly. Mrs. Quabble, to use a colloquial expression, was knocked off her perch. She was one of those imperfectly self-assured individuals who are magnificent and autocratic as long as they are not seriously opposed. The least show of unexpected resistance goes a long way toward rendering them cowed and apologetic. When the new governess failed to express wondering admiration of the large, newly purchased and expensive car, and lightly alluded to the superior advantages of one or two makes which had just been put on the market, the discomfiture of her patroness was almost abject. Her feelings were those which might have been animated a general of ancient warfaring days on beholding his heaviest battle elephant ignominiously driven off the field by slingers and javelin throwers. At dinner that evening, although reinforced by her husband, who usually duplicated her opinions and lent her moral support generally, Mrs. Quabble regained none of her lost ground. The governess not only helped herself well and truly to wine, but held forth with considerable show of critical knowledge on various vintage matters, concerning which the Quabbles were in no wise able to pose as authorities. Previous governesses had limited their conversation on the wine topic to a respectful and doubtless sincere expression of a preference for water. When this one went as far as to recommend a wine firm in whose hands you could not go very far wrong, Mrs. Quabble thought it time to turn the conversation into more usual channels. We got very satisfactory references about you from Canon Teep, she observed. A very estimable man, I should think. He drinks like a fish. He beats his wife. Otherwise, a very lovable character, said the governess imperturbably. My dear Miss Hope, I hope you're exaggerating, exclaimed the Quabbles in unison. Well, one must admit in justice that there is some provocation, continued the romancer. Mrs. Teep is quite the most irritating bridge player I have ever sat down with. Her leads and declarations would condone a certain amount of brutality in her partner. But to souse her with the contents of the only soda water siphon in the house on a Sunday afternoon when one couldn't get another argues an indifference to the comfort of others which I cannot altogether overlook. You may think me hasty in my judgments, but it was practically on account of the siphon incident that I left. We'll talk of this some other time, said Mrs. Quabble hastily. I shall never allude to it again, said the governess with decision. Mrs. Quabble made a welcome diversion by asking what studies the new instructress proposed to inaugurate on the morrow. History, to begin with, Mr. Quabble, she informed him. Ah, history, he observed sagely. Now, in teaching them history, you must take care to interest them in what they learn. You must make them feel that they are being introduced to the life stories of men and women who really lived. I've told her all that, interposed Mrs. Quabble. I teach history on the Schartz-Metterklum method, said the governess loftily. Ah, yes, said her listeners, thinking it expedient to assume an acquaintance, at least with the name.
"What are you children doing out here?" demanded Mrs. Quabble the next morning on finding Irene sitting rather glumly at the head of the stairs, while her sister was perched in an attitude of depressed discomfort on the window seat behind her, with a wolf skin rug almost covering her. "We're having a history lesson," came the unexpected reply. "I'm supposed to be Rome, and Viola up there is the she-wolf. No, not a real wolf, but the figure of one that the Romans used to set store by. I forget why. And Claude and Wilfred have gone to fetch the shabby women." "The shabby women?" "Yes. They have got to carry them off. They didn't want to, but Miss Hope got one of Father's 5 bats, and she said she'd give them a number 9 spanking if they didn't, so they've gone to do it." A loud, angry screaming from the direction of the lawn drew Mrs. Quarball thither in hot haste, fearful lest the threatened castigation might even now be in the process of infliction. The outcry, however, came principally from the 2 small daughters of the lodgekeeper, who were being hauled and pushed towards the house by the panting and disheveled Claude and Wilfred, whose task was rendered even more arduous by the incessant, if not very effectual, attacks of the captured maiden's small brother. The governess, 5 bats in hand, sat negligently on the stone balustrade, presiding over the scene with the cold impartiality of a goddess of battles. A furious and repeated chorus of, "I'll tell mother," rose from the lodge children, but the lodge mother, who was hard of hearing, was for the moment immersed in the preoccupation of her wash tub. After an apprehensive glance in the direction of the lodge, the good woman was gifted with a highly militant temper, which is sometimes the privilege of deafness, Mrs. Quarball flew indignantly to the rescue of the struggling captives. "Wilfred, Claude, let those children go at once. Miss Hope, what on earth is the meaning of this scene?" Early Roman history. The Sabine women. Don't you know? It is the Schwarz-Metterklum method to make children understand history. By acting it themselves, fixes it in their memory, you know. Of course, if, thanks to your interference, your boys go through life thinking that the Sabine women ultimately escaped, I cannot be held responsible. "You may be very modern and clever, Miss Hope," said Mrs. Quarball firmly, "but I should like you to leave here by the next train. Your luggage will be sent after you as soon as it arrives." "I am not certain exactly where I shall be for the next few days," said the dismissed instructress of youth. "You might keep my luggage till I wire my address. There are only a couple of trunks and some golf clubs and a leopard cub." "A leopard cub?" gasped Mrs. Quabble. Even in her departure, this extraordinary person seemed destined to leave a trail of embarrassment behind her. "Well, it's rather left off being a cub. It's more than half grown, you know. A fowl every day, a rabbit on Sundays. That's what it usually gets. Raw beef makes it too excitable. Oh, don't trouble about getting the car for me. I am rather inclined for a walk." And Lady Carlotta strode out of the Quarball horizon. The advent of the genuine Miss Hope, who had made a mistake as to the day on which she was due to arrive, caused a turmoil which that good lady was quite unused to inspiring. Obviously, the Quarball family had been woefully befooled, and a certain amount of relief came with the knowledge. "How tiresome for you, dear Carlotta," said her hostess, when the overdue guest ultimately arrived. "How very tiresome, losing your train and having to stop overnight in a strange place." "Oh, dear, no," said Lady Carlotta. "Not at all tiresome for me."
That was Marion Seldes teaching us a lesson in Saki's story, The Schwarz-Metterklum Method. We'll continue with a story by the Argentine short story writer and novelist Liliana Hecker. The story is called Barclay, or Mariana of the Universe, and it's about two sisters and their mother. That is, if their mother really exists. Well, that is, if anything really exists. The one thing we can be sure of is that the reader, Hope Davis, definitely does exist, and is one of the best actresses around. Here she is to read Liliana Hecker's Barclay, or Mariana of the Universe.
How much longer till Mom comes home? It's the fourth time Mariana has asked that same question. The first time, her sister Lucia answered that she'd be back real soon. The second, that how the heck was she to know when Mom would be back? The third, she didn't answer. She just raised her eyebrows and stared at Mariana. Following which, Mariana decided that things weren't going all that well, and that the best thing to do was not to ask any more questions. Anyhow, she thought, why do I want Mom to come back if I'm here with Lucia? She corrected herself. Why do I want Mom to come back if I'm here with my big sister? She blinked, deeply moved by the thought. Big sisters look after little sisters, she said to herself as if she were reciting a poem. How lucky to have a big sister. Lucia, with large guardian angel wings, hovered for a second over Mariana's head. But in a flash, the winged image was replaced by another, one which returned every time their mother left them on their own. Lucia, eyes bulging out of their sockets, hair in a furious tangle, was pointing at her with a gun. Sometimes there was no gun. Lucia would pounce on her, trying to rip Mariana's eyes out with her nails or strangle her. The reason was always the same. Lucia had gone mad. It is a well-known fact that mad people kill normal people, which meant that if Lucia went mad when they were alone together, she would kill her, Mariana. That was obvious. Therefore, Mariana decides to abandon her good intentions and asks again, for the fourth time, how much longer till Mom comes home? Lucia stops reading and sighs. What I would like to know, she says. And Mariana thinks, she said, I'd like to know. Does one say, I would like to know, or I should like to know? What I'd like to know is why in God's name do you always need Mom around? No. Now she'll ask me no what. She always manages to interfere. But Lucia says nothing, and Mariana continues. I was just curious, that's all. At 12. What do you mean, at 12? Mariana cries out. But it's only 10 to 9 now. I mean at 12. 6 and 6, Lucia says. Mariana howls with laughter at the joke. She laughs so hard that for a moment she thinks she'll die laughing. To tell the truth, she can't imagine there being anyone on earth as funny as her sister. She's the funniest, nicest person in the world, and she'll never go mad. Why should she go mad? She, who's so absolutely terrific. Lou, she says adoringly, let's play something, okay? Let's, okay? I'm reading. Reading what? Mediocre Man. I bet now she'll ask me if I know what Mediocre Man means, and I won't know. And then she'll say, why do you say, ah, you idiot? Quickly, she asks, Lou, I can't remember. What does Mediocre Man mean? The Mediocre Man is the man who has no ideals in life. Ah, this lays her mind at rest because she certainly has ideals in life. She always imagines herself already a grown-up when all her problems will be over and everyone understands her and things turn out fine and the world is wonderful. That's having ideals in life. Lou, she says, we I mean, you and I, we're not mediocre, are we? A pest, Lucia says. That's what you are. Lucia, why is it that you're so unpleasant to everyone, eh? Listen, Mariana, do you mind just letting me read in peace? You're unpleasant to everyone. That's terrible, Lucia. You fight with Mum, you fight with Dad, with everyone. Mariana lets out a deep sigh. You give your parents nothing but trouble, Lucia. Mariana, I wish you'd just drop dead, okay? You're horrible. Lucia, horrible. You don't say that to anyone that you wish them to drop dead, not to your worst enemy, and certainly not to your own sister. That's it. Start to cry. So that afterwards they scream at me and say that I torture you. Afterwards, when? Afterwards, do you know exactly when Mum will be back? Just afterwards. Lucia has gone back to reading Mediocre Man. Afterwards is afterwards. Lifting her eyes and frowning as if she were meditating on something very important. The future, I mean. What future? You said Mum would be back very soon. Lucia shakes her head with resignation and goes back to her book. Yes, of course, she'll be back very soon. No. Yes, of course, no. Is she coming back very soon or isn't she coming back very soon? Lucia glares at Mariana. Then she seems to remember something and smiles briefly. And anyway, what does it matter? And she shrugs her shoulders. What do you mean, what does it matter? You don't know what you're saying, do you? If someone comes home very soon, it means she comes home very soon, doesn't it? If someone comes home, yes. What? I just said that if someone comes home, then yes. Will you please let me read? You're a cow. That's what you are. What you really want is that Mum never comes home again. Lucia closes the book and lays it down on the bed. She sighs. It has nothing to do with my wanting it or not, she explains. What I'm saying is that it simply doesn't matter if Mum is here or there. What do you mean there? Just there, anywhere. It's all the same. Why the same? Lucia rests her chin on both her hands and stares gravely at Mariana. Listen, Mariana, she says, I've got something to tell you. Mum doesn't exist. Mariana jumps. Don't be stupid, okay? She says, trying to look calm. You know Mum doesn't like you saying stupid things like that. They're not stupid things. And anyway, who cares what Mum says if Mum doesn't exist? Lou, I am telling you for the last time, I don't like you saying stupid things, okay? Look, Mariana, Lucia says in a tired tone of voice, I'm not making it up. There's a whole theory about it, a book. What does it say, the book? What I just said, that nothing really exists, that we imagine the world. What do we imagine about the world? Everything. You just want to frighten me, Lucia. Books don't say things like that. What does it say, for real? I've told you 1,000 times. The desk. See? There isn't really a desk there. You just imagine there's a desk. Understand? You, now, this very minute, imagine that you're inside a room, sitting on the bed, talking to me, and you imagine that somewhere else, far away, is Mum. That's why you want Mum to come back. But those places don't really exist. There is no here or far away. It's all inside your head. You are imagining it all. And you? I what? There's you! See? Mariana says with sudden joy. You can't imagine the desk in the same place that I imagine it, can you? You've got it all wrong, Mariana, sweetheart. You just don't understand, as usual. It's not that both of us imagine that the desk is in the same place. It's that you imagine that both of us imagine that the desk is in the same place. No, 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 no. You've got it all wrong. Each of us doesn't imagine things on our own, and one can't guess what the other is imagining. You talk about what you imagine. I say to you, how many pictures are in this room? And I think to myself, there are three pictures in this room. And at exactly the same time, you tell me that there are three pictures in this room. That means that the three pictures are here, that we see them, not that we imagine them, because two people can't imagine the same thing at the same time. Two can't, that's true. What do you mean? I'm saying that two people can't. I don't understand what you're saying. I'm saying that you are also imagining me, Mariana. You're lying. You're lying. You're the biggest liar in the world. I hate you. Lucia, don't you see? If I'm imagining you, how come you know I'm imagining you? I don't know. I don't know anything. You are just making me up, Mariana. You've made up a person called Lucia, who's your sister, and who knows you've made her up. That's all. No. Come on, Lou. Say it isn't true. What about the book? What book? The book that talks about all this? That talks about what? About things not really existing. Ah, the book. The book is also imagined by you. That's a lie, Lucia, a lie. I could never imagine a book like that. I never know about things like that. Don't you understand, Lou? I could never imagine something as complicated as that. But my poor Mariana, that book is nothing compared to the other things you've imagined. Think of history and the law of gravity and maths and all the books ever written in the world and aspirins and the telegraph and planes. Do you realize what you've done? No. Lucia, no, please. Everyone knows about those things. Look, if I bring a lot of people into this room and I say, when I count up to three, we all point at the radio at the same time, then you'll see. We'll all point in the same direction. Let's play at that. Lou, please, come on. Let's play at pointing at things, please. But are you stupid or what? I'm telling you that you are the one who's imagining all the people in the world. I don't believe you. You just say that just to frighten me. I can't imagine all the people in the world. What about Mom? What about Dad? Them too. Then I'm all alone, Lou? Absolutely. All alone. That's a lie. That's a lie. Say you're lying. You're just saying that to frighten me, right? Sure, because everything's here. The bed, the desk, the curtains. I can see them. I can touch them if I want to. Say yes, Lou, so that everything's like before. But why do you want me to say yes if, anyway, it will be you imagining that I am saying yes? Always me? So there's no one but me in the world? Right. And you? As I said, you're imagining me. I don't want to imagine anymore, Lou. I'm afraid. I'm really frightened. Lou, how much longer till Mom comes home? Mariana leans out of the window. Mom, come back soon, she begs. But she no longer knows to whom she's begging or why. She shuts her eyes and the world disappears and she opens them and it appears again. Everything, everything, everything. If she can't think about her mother. She won't have a mother anymore. And if she can't think about the sky and dogs and clouds and God, too many things to think about all at once, all on her own. And why she alone? Why she alone in the universe? When you know about it, it's so difficult. Suddenly she might forget about the sun, or her house, or Lucia, or worse, she might remember Lucia, but a mad Lucia coming to kill her with a gun in her hand. And now she realizes at last how dangerous all this is, because if she can't stop herself thinking about it, then Lucia will really be like that, crazy, and kill her. And then there won't be anyone left to imagine all those things. The trees would disappear, and the desk, and thunderstorms. The color red would disappear, and all the countries in the world, and the blue sky, and the sky at night, and the sparrows, and the lions in Africa, and the earth itself, and singing songs. And no one will ever know that once a girl called Mariana invented a very complicated place to which she gave the name of Universe.
Liliana Hecker's story, Barclay or Mariana of the Universe, read by Hope Davis. After this quick break, we'll continue this program with stories by Charles Johnson and Edwige Dantica. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Calling all writers in our audience, announcing the 2011 Stella Kupferberg Memorial Short Story Prize. This year's theme is stories set in restaurants and bars. The judge is the author Jennifer Egan, and the deadline is March 1st, 2011. All the details can be found at selectedshorts.org. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. For more information about the stories or the readers, go to selectedshorts.org. And we love to hear your reactions and any questions you might have. As you heard earlier, the African-American heroine of our final story, Charles Johnson's Cultural Relativity, doesn't think that there's much of a chance of finding a good man. Then she meets the perfect Mr. Wright, a fellow student who's the son of the president of an African nation. Well, they fall in love, everything is great, but there's one little problem. Regina King reads Charles Johnson's Cultural Relativity.
Thank you. Okay. Not long ago, a college student named Felicia Brooks felt she was the most fortunate young woman in all Seattle, and possibly in the entire world, except for one small problem. She was deeply in love with her boyfriend, an African student who was the only son of his country's president. His name was Fortunata Mafa. In the spring of 2001, they both were graduating seniors at the University of Washington. They had been dating all year long. He was more than she could have ever hoped for, and Felicia knew all her friends thought Fortunata was catnip. In fact, she was afraid sometimes that they might steal him from her. Most of them had given up on black men entirely, or at least they had given up on American black men. Their mantra, which Felicia had heard 1,000 times and often chanted herself, was, "All the good black men are taken, and the rest are in prison, on drugs, or unemployed, or dating white women, or don't like girls at all." What was a sister to do? During high school and college, Felicia and her friends despaired of even finding Mr. Wright. But then, miraculously, she met Fortunata fall quarter at the Langston Hughes Cultural Center. He looked like a young Kwame Nkrumah. He dressed as elegantly as Michael Jordan, was gorgeous the few times she saw him in his Agbada, African robe. And he fit George Bernard Shaw's definition of a gentleman being, a man who always tries to put in a little more than he takes out. Furthermore, he was rich. He could play the kora, an African string instrument, so beautifully, you'd cry. Yet, for all that, he still had a schoolboy shyness and was frequently confused by the way Americans did things, especially by pop culture, which was so sexually frank compared to his own country that it made Fortunata squirm. All of this, Felicia thought, was charming as well as exciting because it meant he was her very own Galatea and she was his Pygmalion, his guide and interpreter on these shores. He dazzled her every day when he described the ancient culture of his father's kingdom in West Africa. There, in that remote world, his people were introducing the most sophisticated technology, and that was why Fortunata had studied computer engineering. But, he said, his people worked hard to avoid the damaging aspects of westernization. They were determined to revolutionize their science, but also to preserve their thousand-year-old traditions, their religions, and their folkways, even when the reason for some of these unique practices had been forgotten. One night in June, after final exams were over, Felicia played for him the movie Coming to America. She played it on the VCR in her studio apartment on Capitol Hill, hoping he would enjoy it, which he did. No sooner was it over that Fortunata slid closer to her on the sofa and said, "I am so like Eddie Murphy in this funny movie. I came to America 4 years ago, not just for an education, but really to find a beautiful American wife, to share my life, to be my queen. Felicia, this woman is you. If you will have me, because if I can't have you, then I don't want anyone. I just won't marry ever." Naturally, Felicia said yes. "And," he added, "you promise not to change your mind, no matter what happens." She did. And from the pocket of his suit coat, Fortunata produced a ring with a flawless 4-carat diamond shaped like the star of South Africa. For precious stones were plentiful in his country, a nation rich in natural resources. Felicia threw her arms around him, and then without thinking, acting on what she believed was instinct, she brought her lips close to his. But before she could kiss Fortunata, he wiggled away. "What?" said Felicia, "what's wrong?" Fortunata gave her a shy, sideways look. His voice trembled. "I'm so sorry, we don't do that." "What?" she said, "you don't kiss?" She looked straight at him. He looked down. "You know I can't." "Why not? Please don't start this again." Now Fortunata seemed nervous. He began rolling the end of his tie between his fingers. "I am not sure why. We just don't. The reason is lost in antiquity, Felicia. It's not that unusual. Polynesians rub noses. You know, Samoans sniff each other. And traditional Japanese and Chinese cultures did not include this strange practice called kissing. I suspect they felt it was too intimate a thing for people to do. All I know is that my father warned me never to do this thing when I came to America. We've discussed this before, don't you remember?" Felicia did remember, but not happily. This was the one thing about Fortunata that baffled and bothered her deeply. She understood that his culture was very traditional. For example, Fortunata's people insisted that sex should not be postponed until should be. Fortunatus' people insisted that sex should be postponed until a couple's wedding night. And all during the past year, they'd done almost everything else that lovers did. They held hands, hugged, and snuggled, but there were no kisses, not even an air kiss. Or a goodnight kiss when he dropped Felicia off at her apartment and returned to his dormitory. The last thing she wanted to be was culturally insensitive, or to offend Fortunato, or to have him break off their nearly perfect relationship. So, on those past occasions, Felicia never insisted that he kissed her. Nor did she insist on the night he summoned up the courage to propose. After taking a deep breath, she said sadly, "Can we rub noses then?" "Of course," said Fortunata. "I think that's okay." It is well known that when two people fall in love, their brains produce an amphetamine-like substance, phenylethylamines. This is what is responsible for what we call lover's high. After Fortunata left, Felicia still felt this chemically created elixir of strong emotion, but she also felt very confused. What she felt, in fact, was half ecstasy that she was to wed the son of an African statesman and half bewilderment because rubbing noses, in her view, was no substitute for a big wet one. She was a highly intelligent woman, a woman about to graduate with a degree in anthropology. She wondered if she was being culturally inflexible, but Felicia knew that all her life, she had been fascinated by and respectful of the differences in cultures, how each was a self-contained and complete system that must be understood from within. She knew her Levi Strauss and the work of dozens of structural anthropologists. You did not have to tell her that in some Muslim countries, it was insulting to cross your legs when sitting if the soles of your shoes were displayed to your host, or that in Theravada Buddhist countries like Thailand, patting a cute youngster on the top of his head was a no-no, because that part of the body was looked upon as sacred. So yes, she had always taken great pains to listen carefully when Fortunata spoke of his country's history and mysterious customs. But she wanted a kiss. Was that asking for so much? I mean, in her heart, she knew that kissing was special. And to prove it to herself, she sat down at her computer, went to the internet, and spent the night looking at everything she could find on the subject. And just as she'd expected, kissing is an expression of love and affection that was old, very old. It dated back to the 5th century. And as a custom, it was even older than that. The early Christians borrowed kissing from the Romans. Clearly, it was the most human of practices. Everyone knew animals didn't kiss, they licked. The reason for having lips in the first place, Felicia decided before daybreak, was so people could use their God-given soup coolers as the most romantic, the most erotic, and the most natural way to show they love someone. During the last year, Felicia had introduced Fortunata to all kinds of things outside his culture. Karaoke, the music of Jimi Hendrix and Kurt Cobain, the importance of Ichiro bobbleheads, and why everyone needed a good-looking tattoo. And he had enjoyed all of it and thanked her for enlightening him as a good Galatea would. When she finally drifted off to sleep around 10 a.m., Felicia wondered if Fortunata had lied. That maybe people in his culture did kiss, but for some reason he simply didn't want to kiss her. But no, she had never caught him in a lie before. It was more likely that he never kissed anyone. So she was certain that if Fortunata could just experience the electric thrill of kissing just once, and with the right woman, meaning herself, then a wonderful new cultural doorway would open for him. If she truly loved him, Felicia knew she owed him that. As luck would have it, Fortunata dropped by unexpectedly that evening as she was fixing dinner. He was almost bursting with excitement. Felicia, he said, I just spoke with my father. I told him about our engagement. We have his blessing. And in my country, the wedding ceremony lasts for a week. Since my father is president, the whole country will celebrate. He paused to catch his breath. Aren't you happy? To show her happiness, Felicia pressed her body against him. Before he could move, she placed her hands on both sides of his head, pulled him closer, puckered up, and bestowed upon him the most soulful, moist, and meaningful lip lock she had ever delivered in her life. Ooh, she felt her heart beat faster, the temperature of her skin beneath her clothes heating up. Smiling, she took a step back. The expression on Fortunata's face was unreadable. He started to speak but stopped, and then suddenly he was gone. Where Fortunata had stood, there was a giant, grown, West African frog. It was a foot long and weighed as much as a fox terrier.
I warned you.
He said. Felicia felt ill. She thought, oh, I can't handle this. But what she said was, I don't suppose we can break off the engagement, can we?
Don't be silly, said the frog.
Regina King. Regina King read Charles Johnson's story, Cultural Relativity. Ribbit, ribbit. Now here's a reading of Edwige Dantica's meditation on Haitian women living in New York City. New York, Day Women, is read for us by Laureen Towler.
Today, walking down the street, I see my mother. She is strolling with a happy gait, her body thrust toward the don't walk sign and the yellow taxicabs that make 45-degree turns on the corner of Madison and 57th Street. I have never seen her in this kind of neighborhood, peering into Chanel and Tiffany's and gawking at the jewels glowing in the Bulgari windows. My mother never shops outside of Brooklyn. She has never seen the advertising office where I work. She is afraid to take the subway, where you may meet those young black militant street preachers who curse black women for straightening their hair. Yet, here she is, my mother, who I left at home that morning in her bathrobe with pieces of newspapers twisted like rollers in her hair. My mother, who accuses me of random offenses as I dash out of the house.
Would you get up and give an old lady like me your subway seat? In this state of mind, I bet you don't even give up your seat to a pregnant lady.
My mother, who was often right about that. Sometimes I get up and give my seat, other times I don't. It all depends on how pregnant the woman is and whether or not she is with her boyfriend or husband and whether or not he is sitting down. As my mother stands in front of Carnegie Hall, one taxi driver yells to another, "What do you think this is, a dance floor?" My mother waits patiently for this dispute to be settled before crossing the street.
In Haiti, when you get hit by a car, the owner of the car gets out and kicks you for getting blood on his bumper.
My mother, who laughs when she says this, and shows a large gap in her mouth where she lost three more molars to the dentist last week. My mother, who at 59 says dentures are okay. You can take them out when they bother you. I'll like them. I'll like them fine. Will it feel empty when Papa kisses you? Oh, no, he doesn't kiss me that way anymore. My mother, who watches the lottery drawing every night on Channel 11 without ever having played the numbers. A third of that money is all I would need. We would pay the mortgage, and your father could stop driving that taxicab all over Brooklyn. I follow my mother, mesmerized by the many possibilities of her journey. Even in a flower dress, she is lost in a sea of pinstripes and gray suits, high heels and elegant short skirts, Reebok sneakers dashing from building to building. My mother, who won't go out to dinner with anyone. If they want to eat with me, let them come to my house, even if I boil water and give it to them. My mother, who talks to herself when she peels the skin off poultry. Fat, you know, and cholesterol. Fat and cholesterol killed your Aunt Hermine. My mother, who makes jam with dried grapefruit peel and then puts in cinnamon bark that I always think is cockroaches in the jam. My mother, whom I have always bought household appliances for on her birthday, a nice rice cooker, a blender. I trail the red orchids in her dress and the heavy faux leather bag on her shoulders. Realizing the ferocious pace of my pursuit, I stop against a wall to rest. My mother keeps on walking as though she owns the sidewalk under her feet. As she heads towards the Plaza Hotel, a bicycle messenger swings so close to her that I want to dash forward and rescue her, but she stands dead in her tracks and lets him ride around her, and then goes on. My mother stops at a corner hot dog stand and asks for something. The vendor hands her a can of soda that she slips into her bag. She stops by another vendor selling sundresses for $7 each. I can tell that she is looking at an African print dress, contemplating my size. I think to myself, please, Ma, don't buy it. It would be just another thing that I would bury in the garage or give to Goodwill. Why should we give to Goodwill when there are so many people back home who need clothes? We save our clothes for the relatives in Haiti. 20 years we have been saving all kinds of things for the relatives in Haiti. I need the place in the garage for an exercise bike. You are pretty enough to be a stewardess. Only dogs like bones. This mother of mine, she stops at another hot dog vendor's and buys a Frankfurter that she eats on the street. I never knew that she ate Frankfurters. With her blood pressure, she shouldn't eat anything with sodium. She has to be careful with her heart, this day woman. I cannot just swallow salt. Salt is heavier than 100 bags of shame. She is slowing her pace, and now I am too close. If she turns around, she might see me. I let her walk into the park before I start to follow again. My mother walks toward the sandbox in the middle of the park. There, a woman is waiting with a child. The woman is wearing a leotard with biker shorts and has small weights in her hands. The woman kisses the child goodbye and surrenders him to my mother. Then she bolts off, running on the cemented stretches in the park. The child, given to my mother, has frizzy blonde hair. His hand slips into hers easily, like he's known her for a long time. When he raises his face to look at my mother, it is as though he is looking at the sky. My mother gives this child the soda that she bought from the vendor on the street corner. The child's face lights up as she puts in a straw in the can for him. This seems to be a conspiracy just between the two of them. My mother and the child sit and watch the other children play in the sandbox. The child pulls out a comic book from a knapsack with Big Bird on the back. My mother peers into his comic book. My mother, who taught herself to read as a little girl in Haiti from the books that her brothers brought home from school. My mother, who has now lost 6 of her 7 sisters in Ville Rose and has never had the strength to return for their funerals. Many graves to kiss when I go back. Many graves to kiss. She throws away the empty soda can when the child is done with it. I wait and watch from a corner until the woman in the leotard and biker shorts returns, sweaty and breathless, an hour later. My mother gives the woman back her child and strolls farther into the park. I turn around and start to walk out of the park before my mother can see me. My lunch hour is long since gone. I have to hurry back to work. I walk through a cluster of joggers, then race to a Sweden Tours bus. I stand behind the bus and take a peek at my mother in the park. She is standing in a circle, chatting with a group of women who are taking other people's children on an afternoon outing. They look like a Third World Parent-Teacher Association meeting. I quickly jump into a cab, heading back to the office. Would Ma have said hello had she been the one to see me first? As the cab races away from the park, it occurs to me that perhaps one day I would chase an old woman down a street by mistake, and that old woman would be somebody else's mother, who I would have mistaken for mine. Day women come out when nobody expects them. Tonight on the subway, I will get up and give my seat to a pregnant woman or a lady about Ma's age. My mother, who stuffs thimbles in her mouth and then blows up her cheeks like Dizzy Gillespie while sewing yet another Raggedy Ann doll that she named Suzette after me. I will have all these little Suzettes in case you never have any babies, which looks more and more like it is going to happen. My mother, who had me when she was 33, l'âge du Christ, at the age that Christ died on the cross. Oh, that's a blessing, believe you me. Even if American doctors say by that time you can make retarded babies. My mother, who sews lace collars on my company softball t-shirts when she does my laundry. Why you can't you look like a lady playing softball? My mother, who never went to any of my parent-teacher association meetings when I was in school. Oh, you're so good anyway. What are they going to tell me? I don't want to make you ashamed of this day, woman. Shame is heavier than 100 bags of salt.
Laureen Towler read New York Day Women by Edwige Dantica. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The president of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott, and the artistic director of Symphony Space is Laura Kaminsky. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our programs, presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles, are recorded by Phil Richards. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2010 by Richard Russo. Additional support has been provided by Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is also supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for this program comes from this station and public radio international stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.